Welcome to the Cambridge Tech Podcast, talking all things technology from the heart of the UK's tech capital. Here are your hosts, Faye Holland and James Parton.
Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Faye. So, James, how's your week been?
You're going to be surprised, because this week I've spent a lot of time on podcast admin.
Wow, good.
Yeah, I know. I know you're probably falling off your chair, not for the first time. But we've got we've got lots of stuff going on behind the scenes, which we're all very excited about. New sponsors, lots of new guests and planning calls with the different guests. And yeah, another busy week at the Bradfield. And with my agency hat on, I had a really interesting conversation with the ex-head of developer relations at OpenAI, who are obviously hot property right now. So that was an interesting conversation.
Have you been swatting up then? So we've got quite a few AI interviews coming up, episodes coming up. Have you been swatting up?
Not really. I mean, I'm keeping hopefully abreast of what's going on out there. I mean, we did something like 20 AI startup interviews last year as well, right? So we both must be picking some interesting stuff up, I hope.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
What was your week like?
There was a lot of the wrapping up of 21 to watch, as you would expect, which was pretty busy, but great. I mean, serious amount of traction. Startups magazine covered it. Lots of interactions on social. So it's been really good. I spent my Wednesday afternoon at school. I went to a Form the Future careers carousel, trying to explain to pupils and the future workforce about what their career in marketing is like. And actually, it was absolutely brilliant. They were really interesting. They picked, so I got them all to pick a brand and then we work through what do they like, how is it communicated. So it's kind of like, you know, a bit of education in practice, just so they got an insight into what marketing was like. And they all picked, apart from one group I'll come back to, brands like Rolex, Aston Martin, Chanel, right? You know, so that was kind of like crikey. But one chose Meta. And so I'm like, okay, fine. So we started running the exercise. And all they then did was explained why they didn't like Meta and the privacy concerns. So it was complete, it ended up being like a crisis comms session with them. But I thought that was like really interesting because they're year 12 at school. So that's lower six, you know, completely different generation, and they're not enjoying certain elements of tech. But they did, actually, they did tell me about an influencer on TikTok that if this person said it, then they'd maybe believe it a little bit more. So I went home and I asked my son about this influencer, and he's like, "Mom, do not put that on anything." He's just, "No, definitely not." So shows how much I know about TikTok influencers, doesn't it? There you go.
Yeah.
So varied week, you know, good week, you know, kind of getting a little bit back to normal like yourself, but not desiring to do too much admin at the moment though. So I'll leave that one with you.
Okay. Well, on that note then, shall we move on to this week's tech news? So Arm are in the news. They've made a move into autonomous vehicle technology. Along with its global ecosystem partners, Arm has this week unveiled a new line of chips for the automotive industry.
Cambridge-based gene synthesis pioneer Evonetics, they raised $20 million last year, have appointed an experienced new CEO to steer the business globally. Andrew Diston is the former head of medical technology at Cambridge Consultants, and he has now taken the reins.
We've got two River Lane stories this week. The quantum computing innovator has been granted two patents in the United States for its power-aware transmission of quantum control signals and quantum computing apparatus and associated methods. Both patents tackle one of the commercial quantum computing's biggest challenges, which is engineering energy-efficient machines. And in the second story, River Lane and partners Rolls-Royce and Xanadu have secured more than $400,000 in grant funding from Innovate UK to accelerate the development of applications that will allow quantum computers to model the flow of air through jet engines.
I feel like we should do a regular slot on River Lane. It's like they are in the news all the time. I mean, they're really doing brilliantly, aren't they? So congrats to Steve and the team over there. And the final piece of news is, I'm sure most of you will have seen this locally, the first cohort of young deep tech entrepreneurs developing game-changing solutions to global challenges have been chosen for the inaugural Start Accelerator 1.0, piloted by founders at the University of Cambridge. The program is designed to fast track and smooth the path to success, allowing these Cambridge startups to compete with emerging companies from the likes of MIT and Stanford in the US and ETH Zurich in Europe. It's basically a 12-week program, and the teams will also receive non-dilutive seed funding from a pool of up to £2 million, which includes funding both from the University of Cambridge and from investor partner Parkwalk Advisors.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of us in the Cambridge ecosystem will be familiar with many of the first 11 cohort. Many of them have been through the different kind of feeder programs in the Cambridge ecosystem, which is a great demonstration of how the ecosystem comes together, collaborates, and nurtures companies as they go through their growth journey.
Yeah, brilliant.
I just wanted to quickly shout out some upcoming local tech events. If you are listening and you do have a tech event that you'd like us to plug, please send them over. First, we have Growing as a Founder When Scaling a Business, which is on the 21st of March between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. over at the Jeffrey Chia Biomedical Center, which features a masterclass and networking with Jonathan Milner, which is for life science and biotech founders preparing for a Series A raise. And you can find tickets to that event on Eventbrite. And then on the 28th of March from 5 p.m. at the Bradfield Centre, there is a Trailblazing Women in STEM event. You can get all the details from the Bradfield website.
And we can share those on the Cambridge Tech Podcast LinkedIn feed as well. So that might be an easy way of heading over to those events. Brilliant. So let's move on to today's episode. I'm thrilled to have Sheila Kissan with us today. Sheila was one of the very first people, actually, who reached out to us when we first started the podcast. And I previously worked with her as a guest speaker at an Impact Women's Network event back in 2019. Welcome, Sheila. It's great to see you again. Let's start by you introducing yourself.
Thank you so much. My name is Sheila Kissan Marshall. I'm the founding CEO of Boutros Bear. And my background prior to starting Boutros Bear was in civil engineering. And I know we'll touch on that and what that career looked like. And I founded the company number of years ago now in 2020, following my own diagnosis of an aggressive form of breast cancer. It was in response to the fact, although I'd had exceptional treatment, including targeted therapies, there was nothing to support my mental and physical rehabilitation.
So we meet lots of founders on the podcast every week, and there's always different, you know, ways that business ideas come about and companies are formed. Yours obviously came from a very challenging personal situation. What was that spark for you to actually, you know, do something about it and actually create a company to benefit others?
Yeah, so that, I guess the big burning platform for me was that my children were one and two. So I'd had a year's worth of treatment. It was incredibly debilitating. So I don't think that, unless you're in the space of oncology, I think most of us don't realise just how tough it can actually be. And of course, everyone's treatment and journey is different. But I had an aggressive form of breast cancer. I feel absolutely blessed that it was discovered very early. So although it was aggressive, it was found at an early stage, which is enormously helpful for treatment, successful treatment and long-term survivorship. So my children being so young, you know, raising them and going through treatment, and there were days by the end of it, obviously I lost all my hair, all of my skin, the top layer of my skin was gone almost throughout my body. So my skin would just weep and bleed. And a lot of people with going through oncology have a permanent runny nose, because all of the hairs in your nose that normally support that are all gone. So all my fingernails and my toenails had gone, so then my fingers were raw and I had a lot of nerve damage. So by the time I'd finished, I could barely cross the room to walk. And before this, I'd been, you know, a very strong person. I'd had a career in civil engineering before children. And it just was not acceptable to me that I wouldn't get a complete return to mobility and be able to raise my children. So, of course, all of the NHS systems and the private medical systems are all set up to give you everything to get through your treatment. And I had a mastectomy and amazing reconstruction surgery, which is taking skin grafts and fat from your stomach. Having had two children, that was quite welcomed, if I'm going to be honest. And it's, you know, they give you a great result. But you can imagine that all of that surgery and then radiotherapy afterwards and more targeted therapies is a lot for the body. So when I went to a physio sort of discussion at the hospital and said, how do I actually regain full movement post-mastectomy? I was told it's unlikely, but you can start to walk your arm up the wall and start to sort of stretch out. And I was absolutely raging because I kept meeting women who had had mastectomy, some single, some double, who were told that there wasn't a way of regaining movement. But yet everything I had read during my treatment suggested that the backstroke was an amazing motion to be able to get that full swing of movement while you're supported in the water. So I'd learned all of these things and I thought, well, if I can't get it anywhere else, I will get it myself. So I went to the Nuffield group who'd given me oncology, and Lorraine Sizer, who at the time was the oncology manager, she's now their clinical director. She said, I absolutely believe in this too. Let's get a bit of funding and let's put a program together and put you through it. So we did. And over 12 weeks, I went from, you know, a sort of driveling wreck really and terrified and barely could move in searing pain to somebody who could run 5K and this whole new lease of life. And I learned to swim as an adult. And I learnt the backstroke. And of course, this has now given me 100% return to mobility. So once we knew that it was working, we then said, how do we do this for everyone? Because I'd met so many people through the system, like me, that were on their own, that were going through radiotherapy, recognising they were going to be left disabled at the end of this. And it just made me rage with anger. So I never came from this from a place of, this will be a nice thing to do. I thought, I'm so angry. We can't leave people like this. When they've had such exceptional care, they have to have the rehabilitation. So we advertised for a 12-week programme, a group program. We trained people in level 4 cancer care. We run the classes at the Nuffield gym and we put the posters up. I went and sat waiting for people to ring their bell and said, hey, listen, I've got this class starting and please come and we will give you your mobility back. We will support your mental health as well. And as soon as we got to 14 people, we launched and started a class. You know, it's one of those funny things. You advertise it and they come. And we created this amazing community. And on World Cancer Day, actually, I put a note out to the WhatsApp group, we're all still connected, and said, whoever's around, let's get together. And we got together. And I can't even tell you how emotional it was, because those programs of 12 weeks of having physical therapy, a return to movement, counseling, psychology and dietary advice, and telling everyone, you're doing great, you're going to get better, you're going to have long-term survivorship, was transformational for people. And it was just so, yeah, it felt really emotional, this World Cancer Day, to sort of celebrate with the people that we first started with. It was beautiful.
I mean, we'll certainly come back and talk about the community side of it and the relationships that are built from this. But, you know, hearing you describe how impactful the treatment was to both you and your family, what was the elapsed time between going through that, recovering, going through your own rehab, and then starting the business? Because I can't imagine anything more exhausting than actually starting your own company and becoming like a founder of a business as well. So you're not giving yourself much time off here.
James, honest to God, I literally walked out of radiotherapy thinking, what now? How do I fix this? But even having had a busy professional life, also when I was going through treatment, I was in complete denial. So I kept thinking, when they told me, you've got cancer, well, none of us are that person who gets cancer. It's just not us. It's somebody else. It's out there, but it's not us. And I kept saying to Robert, nobody needs to be embarrassed, but when they tell us they messed up the results, it's not my results, they've read somebody else's results. And we were both in this complete denial. I think Robert, my husband, is still in denial that it ever happened, to be frank. But, you know, there's this utter denial. And then once I realised whether I liked it or not, I was going to be given oncology. And of course, nobody, you know, you get this word choice. You're going to choose to go on oncology. It is, you are given a choice, but the choice is stark. It's either try this oncology, and it is try. It's not this is going to work. It's see how it goes, or you're going to be dead in about 3 to 6 months, you know. And also, if you take this oncology, there is a chance that that drug, you don't survive the first dose. And so the day I left for that first oncology, I had my picture taken with my children, and I thought, and I dressed up and I looked lovely, and it's a gorgeous picture. And you would never know that that woman was walking out the door thinking, am I going to see these little kids again or not? And how the hell is this fella going to cope with these? Yeah, I went through that process of oncology, looking at it, what works, what doesn't, what's wrong with the system. And I think it was my way of staying sane. So as a civil engineer, I was always time trialing things, working with innovation and continuous improvement. And I thought, how would I improve this system? What's wrong? What are the gaps? And I did it as a way of just feeling that I had some control over something when I really didn't. So I started thinking about it throughout the process. And when I finished the first radiotherapy, I went to Grantchester Meadow and I did a run, sort of fell over at the end of 100 yards. But I thought, actually, if this works and I can rehabilitate myself, then we can do it for others. So to answer your question in a long way, I came out of that and went straight into what we originally called, because it was for breast cancer, Bosom Buddies, and started immediately. With an enormous level of naivety, because of course I didn't realise just how exhausting and emotional it is to be a founder of a business and to raise capital and to then be responsible for capital investment that people have trusted you with that money. Mm. So I was entirely ill-equipped for that level of what I was actually taking on, and I did it anyway. And before I knew it, it was done. And then I thought, holy cow, what have I done?
Yeah, it's amazing. So I think that the key things that are coming out of that is your motivation was almost the rage, wasn't it? You know, everyone's got to have the motivation for something, and yours was like that rage and frustration. But also what's really interesting is that it was you weren't willing to accept. So you've got a really unique perspective from the patient side of it, as I knew I'd got this amount of help, but then I was on my own. So just that absolute desire, I guess, to go fix it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And what I realised when we got our first group together, when we did the first survey at the end of it, so we tracked their levels of stress, anxiety, depression and quality of life. And when they came back with the surveys, and we had a free text box at the end, what else is it that was, you know, did you enjoy the exercise classes, the movement range, the dietary advice, the mental health support? What was it exactly that really sort of made the impact for you? And what we learned, of course, which I hadn't had when I was going through it, was that all of that was great, but having each other, having that community of people, I think it's not probably widely known unless one finds himself in that situation, that when somebody has a treatment, it's not a treatment plan, it's a discussion. So you might be, if it was appropriate, you might be asked that if there was a possibility, say, for a lumpectomy rather than a full mastectomy, or you can have a mastectomy and stay flat, or use, you know, tissue like I did from the stomach to create a new breast. But these are choices that you make. And without having a community to have those discussions with and see what somebody else has done and how it worked for them, I think you just don't know. So I never had that. And of course, when this community came together, we talked about it again on World Cancer Day, that somebody had said to me, well, what is a reconstruction? We were up at Wimpole having one of our walks. We regularly walk together as a group. And I said, well, there's nobody around, I'll show you. And everyone laughed their heads off as I got my breasts out to show somebody else who faced that choice. And of course, this is the beauty of when you're in this space of complete and utter sort of acceptance. And oh, that's what it's like. And can I feel it? And what's it look like? And how does it feel? And I think without that community, you would never know that. So, you know, that is, I think that was the magic that I found of the bringing people together to have this program.
I mean, I can see where the rage comes from, because it's bizarre that none of this existed, you know, because these aren't new challenges, right? These aren't new problems.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'll just answer that bit, James. So I've asked this question very specifically to the oncologist. So the why is this not there? And of course, when it boils down to it, when you get to that third or fourth why and you sort of really understand, if you think back even sort of 10 years ago, when somebody had a cancer diagnosis or an aggressive cancer diagnosis, it was almost a death sentence, wasn't it? You know, we all knew that there was a lot of people who died quite fast from cancer. So what's happened is that the treatments for cancer have become absolutely incredible at various types of cancer as well. So even in the breast cancer space, there is an enormous amount of variation in that. And so things like Herceptin, which was invented by Sir Greg Winter's company, Bicycle Therapeutics, probably, I don't know how many years ago, probably 12, 14 years ago, something like that, I guess. So very, very new drugs, but it's meant that people who have those drugs have a very long life expectancy and a very good quality of life, providing they get the rehabilitation. But the life expectancy is going up 20, 30 years. Even now, with some of the other drugs and some of the other Cambridge drug companies are looking at secondary breast cancer drugs. They are now extending lives of patients with secondary breast cancer for 10, 20 odd years, which is exceptional. So I think that when it was putting three people through cancer treatments, there was a feeling that you get through it, you get your affairs in order, and that's pretty much it. But the world has moved on from that now. We've now got the ability to go back to work. We have to go back to work and earn a living, and we have the ability to have these long lives. So why has this not caught up? It's a question I ask. And I think that from a stretched national healthcare service, it's purely a cost basis. So at Adam Brooks, we have an exceptional program called REACT, and it's run by their physiotherapists. So those who are in the greatest need will be able to be supported by the REACT program. But of course, there's way more patients than can access that program. And I'm not 100% sure how that translates to other areas, but they've been very forward in recognising the need for this service. They just don't have the resourcing and the funding to pay for it.
So Sheila, it's obviously got to be very personal, very community-based. You know, you go for your walks, all of those kinds of things. But what else is Boutros Bear doing? You know, so do you have the online equivalent for people that can't come in person? You know, what are your plans to use technology to actually amplify what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So we realised, having done those programmes and seeing the success, then people very quickly said to me, well, that's all very interesting. How do you scale it? You know, and the way you scale it is obviously through tech. And my feeling in creating the tech was the tech should be there to serve the needs of the people, not creating tech for the sake of tech. So I very much went about it. One of the first advisors I had was James Green from Green Custard, who was absolutely fantastic. And I'd scoped many things as an engineer, but I'd never scoped tech. So he helped me to think about a scope of works. And I remember that I would go to him month, or he won't mind me saying this, I'm sure, but I used to go to him month after month and say, I've scoped what I think we need. And he'd say, that's not a scope of work for tech. You know, it really isn't. And I realised that I would need support to find somebody to actually help me to scope out what this platform would look like. So I raised an investment round of 750,000, our pre-seed round that was 2021. And this enabled me, having looked at that scope, having worked with people to understand how we could support people and scale this into a business, I recognised very early it should be a business and not a charity, because I wanted to be able to raise funds and make it something sustainable. I didn't see myself going out shaking a tin for this. I saw it as a sustainable, impactful business. So off the back of that, we scoped the tech. We then brought on board a tech team. And what I felt was really valuable online was the ability, this was pre-COVID, so we were still in the place that we weren't all used to, you know, Zoom calls and all the rest of it, but we recognised that we could do online health coaching. So we work with allied healthcare professionals, most of them are physiotherapists, so the health coaching you can do on an online setting is very profound. We were tracking to wearables, so the health coach could set those exercise goals, and instead of being in a gym setting, over the 45-minute call, they could show people how to move, how to increase their range of movement, and then to plan their exercise for the week, a month ahead. So that was one aspect of it. It's just that connectivity to the health coaches anywhere in the country. The second part was most people post-cancer want to really look at their diet. They want to move towards an anti-inflammatory diet. So we created hundreds of recipes, and we have dietitians. Again, they have dietary advice calls, people on our programs, and they get issued with personalised meal plans. the third aspect in terms of the exercise, which I was absolutely delighted. It took 18 months to sort of stalk this amazing woman in the US in LA called BodyFit by Amy. She has over 1 million online users. And I worked out with her programs at home. So her specialism had been sort of postpartum. So everything is here's level one, here's level two, here's level three. Here's for those that have had, you know, stomach surgery or something like that. And I found as a cancer patient, she had this brilliant way of making me feel like a hero, no matter how much I'd done of that class. So for 18 months, I emailed her constantly, said, I would love you to be our trainer and record in your beautiful studio our programs. And her father-in-law had a cancer diagnosis and sadly passed away. And then she got in touch with me and said, I can really see how we can help. So my husband and I, it was his father, we want to help and we're going to do it. And we've got a great studio and they recorded all of our exercise classes. And I honestly, of all of the things, it's one of those things you can't stop asking, can you? And I've learned that again, I think, as a founding CEO of a startup, that there are many ways of asking. And sometimes it takes time to build these relationships, but people aren't saying no because they want to say no, because they've got other things going on. And sometimes it might fall into place. So we had the exercise element online and it's basically turned into a 12-week program online each week. There's educational content and our videos unlocked new exercise classes, which is graded to the individual's needs. There's counseling psychology information. They book in to see their counseling psychologists, they book in to see their health coaches, and we track to their wearables to see how they're getting on. And of course, a lot of this is changing habits post-cancer to reduce risk of reoccurrence. And so much of that is we all know what we should be eating. We all know we should be exercising. The World Health Organization says 150 minutes a week or 75. But the reality is we need support to be able to do that and make that profound change. And you need somebody to say, you're doing great. And okay, you had a bad week. So what? It's 1 week. It doesn't matter. Get on. And also, I think that as humans, when we go about these changes, like we see in January, the car park of a gym is full in January. By February, it drops off because we haven't got that person, that guardian telling us you did great. It's a bad week. And next week we're going again. And I think that is the utter joy of having a health coach. You see this sustained change. It's small changes week on week on week on week on week. And that is the beauty that we can deliver online. We also have e-learning videos, which is really important. So one of our sales channels is to employers. So a lot of employers, of course, don't really understand how best to support cancer patients legally, what they should do, and morally how to support people. So we've created some very high quality e-learning programs with Kate Silverton, BBC Newsreader, and various other newsreaders. So it's really nice to watch. And they are all on there, scalable for employers to be able to sign up to, and they can train their staff in the sort of mandatory compliance aspects of supporting people with chronic illness. And of course, we've talked a lot about cancer, but what I learned early on in supporting cancer patients is that 75% of them have chronic pain. So this can be post-surgical, you know, somebody with prostate cancer, they've had the prostate removed, but they're having bladder issues and pain around the site, and the body doesn't know how to turn off those pain signals. So I knew that to be able to really support people, we had to have a profound understanding of chronic pain. It's the biggest issue in a global healthcare setting nowadays. It affects 25 to 30% of people in the workplace. And in the most extreme cases, this is people who are now relying on opioids. And in the UK, we have a big problem with that. So I worked on chronic pain understanding. I reached out to one of the experts in chronic pain across the UK and Europe, Dr. Deepak Ravindran. I'd read his book, which is absolutely fantastic, The Pain-Free Mindset. And over a period of time, sort of stalked him until he said, yes, I will be your chief medical officer and I will design this program. So we have the chronic pain program now that sits alongside cancer for cancer patients, but also for those in chronic pain, musculoskeletal, back pain, neck pain, that sort of thing. And then, of course, we realized that the menopause is a big issue for people going through early cancer. So we had a menopause program and we have a lady in Cambridge called Dr. Susan Unsworth who leads that, as well as nobody goes through chronic illness without a burden to their mental health. So we then realized that it was important for us to be able to support the mental health. And Dr. Sarah Baitup is our leading clinician for our counseling psychology program.
I mean, there's so much to unpack from that.
But the first thing I wanted to come in on was, I mean, you just described there so many kind of product lines, content, e-learning, diversification in terms of the medical areas that you're covering, B2B, B2C. So when you first kind of were fueled by that personal experience and that anger that you described, were you always thinking that actually this is going to be, you know, an opportunity to disrupt, I guess, medtech? Or did you start small and then just kind of uncovered more opportunities you went? Or did you start with a big vision? Just kind of interested to how you approached that as a founder.
I think it grew out of realizing that, starting with the cancer, that there were these things that we had to have the understanding of. So we had to understand chronic pain and be able to support people. We had to understand menopause, and we couldn't treat their physical needs without thinking about their mental well-being and health. Mm. And I never saw any of this as being a passive app. You know, there's a hell of a lot of passive apps out there that for all of these things and others, and are they impactful in driving change? I don't believe so. So my feeling was that we've grown into these areas because we've needed to be able to be a truly holistic company and supporting people's needs. And it's just interesting now that, of course, if you look at it statistically, the biggest statistic in terms of what we need is chronic pain support, you know, in a workplace. And some of this, of course, was a response to who's the payer. So very early on when you're, you know, raising money, who is paying for this? And of course, one would imagine the NHS might be an option, but it's also incredibly difficult to get going in an NHS setting. So that wasn't an avenue that I thought would be the route to market. I saw the route to market is through employers, because I think I could see this trend was coming, that there is a greater expectation for employers to support the mental and physical health of their employees. They also have a hell of a lot to gain from it, because if you are not supporting people who are coming back into the organisation with a form of chronic illness, they're going to have large levels of presenteeism, absenteeism. It's going to affect your bottom line. So for that reason, I wanted to be in the, you know, employer space. And the other sort of area for us is, of course, insurance companies that pay out income protection. So income protection kicks in generally 12 weeks post going sick, and it can be 65 to 75% of salary until retirement. Happy days. You know, this is a windfall for people. But of course, people don't want to be off work. They don't want to fall into that lifestyle of being at home and out of the normal life system, particularly those with young children. I'm sure it never feels good. And so we have a lot of value add when we work with insurance companies to be able to support people so that they don't go as far as having an income protection claim, but we rehabilitate them and keep them in the workplace. And that's great for everyone. And this is, you know, we're seeing the government talk about people economically inactive. There's also a really worrying figure of 3.4 million who've got work-limiting conditions, and this is showing up in the workplace, and they're in and out of the workplace. And I think that there's been, you know, if you roll back 2 years ago, there was a hell of a lot of tech bought for well-being in the workplace, and a lot of it was quite passive apps. And I think that the world has recognised that, are they driving long-term behavioural changes? Are people actually staying engaged with them and getting something out of it? And I think that nowadays, a lot of those sales are not being repeated because they're too passive. So I think there was this great drive for the trendy tech. But I would argue that the tech has to support the outcomes that we're looking for, and they should be clinical. So that's my feeling.
If you are a startup looking to grow in Cambridge, the Bradfield Centre offers a range of flexible membership packages which put you in control of your office and home working mix. There's a vibrant, collaborative atmosphere, on-site cafe, plenty of green outside space, and regular member social events. We also offer a range of high-quality meeting spaces for hire, and for tech event organisers, our auditorium, Lakeside Pavilion and Atrium spaces are perfect to bring your communities together for in-person and hybrid events. For more information, visit bradfieldcentre.com or call 01223 919 600.
So Sheila, just going onto the corporate side of it, how are you finding the approach to them? How are they reacting to you? Are you starting to get that level of traction?
Oh, Faye, I think it's really tough because we have been in this world of health and well-being. Well, two things. First of all, when companies selling health and well-being solutions, they tend to be selling in the assumption that only 4-7% are using it. And obviously, from my side, I want all of the cancer patients and those in chronic pain to be using it. I want to see them getting better. So I'm driven by that. But when you are pricing health and well-being solutions, the general pricing of, you know, your EAP providers, any health and well-being benefit package, it is being sold in at a low level of usage in the organisation, which I think is a great shame because, again, you don't drive impact. And it's also an incredibly low rate per employee in that organisation. So, you know, a cash plan provider will be selling that into a large, or it could be an enterprise company, for a couple of pounds per employee. What can you do with that in terms of sustainable, meaningful change to somebody? Very little is the answer. So we've seen a wave of that. And we recently priced for one of the really forward-thinking health and well-being companies. And we priced them a policy to be able to support cancer, chronic pain, mental health in the workplace. And we came up with what I thought was a very good figure because we introduced group-based programs as well as, you know, one-to-one programs. On a group, obviously, the price is, you know, 6-8 times lower, basically. And it was too high. And that was at sort of £7 per employee. So we've had to really go away and look at what can we deliver and still make meaningful change in the world of this pricing. And I've seen in construction, we called it a race to the bottom, where, you know, there was these big contracts for work and contractors would price lower and lower to win the job, or they'd rely on claims. And in the health and well-being space, there's a lot about driving a SaaS model. So turn it on, scale it up at very low on cost, and that's going to sort out your mental health. So, for example, lots of companies have bought mindfulness, which is a brilliant tool in a box of tricks to sort out mental health. But it is very different to counselling, psychology, health coaching, dietary advice. And it's very hard to compete with a 50p per employee app when you want to provide £95 an hour counselling psychology. So it's tough. So we have made early sales. They're companies that I think really value the impact that these programs have on people. We see a 67% reduction in clinical depression, and that is an incredible result. We have 100% of people completing our programs. You will never see that on a passive app. You're lucky if they've downloaded it and used it 3 times. So we have this amazing ability to capture people, to make profound change. We see exercise levels sustained in the long run, and we see people who are engaged and feeling in control, which gives them this high level of quality of life. So I think that it's something we're going to have to really think about as to who is going to benefit from that the most, who's going to be willing to pay the prices for it. And some organisations are coming forward and saying, yes, I want that. We're just in talks with doing some lunch and learn sessions at one of the parks in Cambridge with a lot of science companies on it. And I think that when employers can start to meet some of the people that have been through our programs and talk about how it kept them in the workplace, they'll start to see the value add. And I think that's going to be really helpful. Income protection, as I said, it's like a 500x return on investment because they're not paying out these enormous claims, which is now, you know, they're all reporting £500-600 million a year of drawdown on income protection, which is not sustainable. So they have to act. And one of them, Legal & General, came out recently and secured Percy Health as a partner, which is they concentrate purely on cancer. But I think for us, this is brilliant. You know, we are delighted for them. And it shows that this is being understood, that there is a need for it and there's a price associated with it, and it's not pounds and pennies.
I mean, it's really interesting where you started to describe there the kind of that typical SaaS scaling model and, you know, as you describe them, passive apps. I just wanted to ask you a question around your kind of investors. You know, I don't know if you can kind of share who your investors were, if they were local or national, international, but, you know, have you managed to find investors that understand that you're different and understand that you're going more for that expert-led model rather than a pure software-led model? And, you know, I guess the proof really is in the pudding, as you're describing, in terms of the impact on the actual end users.
Yeah, so our first investor was, you can imagine, you know, you've had a lot of no's, you're raising your first round, and the first person who said, I really like it and I get it, you're going to have to speak to my investor director because he has the call on this. And that was Jonathan Milner. I then had a scheduled call with Mike Murphy, and, you know, it wasn't on the call, but not long afterwards, he said yes. And again, it was slightly outside their normal investment codes, I would say. So we were definitely a bit of a wild card. They saw something. Jonathan has obviously worked in the space. He trained in breast cancer and is very knowledgeable, obviously. So they saw this, I think, trend that there could be something in this and we could use tech to scale it, but that there was going to be an on cost. So he was the first investor. David Cleveley followed not long afterwards, which was, again, utterly fantastic. Been hugely well supported by Matthew, who had an exit just over a year ago. And actually, he's spent a bit of time with us in the last month where we've been really understanding the SaaS aspect. So all of our pre-recorded content, you can turn it on and fire it up and it's completely scalable. Happy days. And what I've had to learn and adjust to is that for some employers, they want to be able to tick a box to say, I need that mandatory training. That's really exciting for us that we can have your training. We can pay 50p an employee or whatever, and we can scale this stuff up. So I've had to learn that this is the market in which we operate and some of our services have to suit the needs. And Matthew, with his business, which was 10 to 8, a booking system, he actually gave us the booking system when we first started for Butchspare, which was brilliant. And he's helped me to understand the pricing that you land and expand so that you go in, you've got the mandatory compliance aspect, you can scale up the SaaS at a very low cost, and then you have people, as you get to know the organisation, the HR director, you can then demonstrate your value and how you can support their employees. So I've learned a hell of a lot from our investors as well. A number of other Cambridge Angels are on our cap table. Again, Amadeus Capital was delighted that Emilio is our investor partner and she supported us. And again, I think it's fair to say that we were a bit of a wild card. They have a pot for, you know, the wild card fund, and we're definitely in that gap. And I think they're pretty delighted actually with how we're going, that we've done something where we recognise you have the SaaS and the ability to scale, but you've got this higher price point but delivers enormous levels of transformational change, massive reduction in clinical depression, massive increase in quality of life, and we don't know anyone out there in the market who's doing that. Not to say that I think that others will emerge, and I think there's space and there's room for it.
I think the fact you just said you were a bit of a wild card. You know, when we line people up, obviously, to come on the podcast, and you're not really a typical person that would come on the podcast, but you are, for that exact reason of being a wild card. And what you've just explained there in terms of the journey and the people and the connections you've made is a real Cambridge success story as well. So I guess that whole ecosystem is integral to what you've done to date.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what you end up with is the ability to get first class advice and people around you with a background way off this sort of technology. But in as a civil engineer, I had learned to work with multidiscipline teams, often internationally, and had to learn, you know, things like I looked after some fuel farms and building runways and that sort of thing. And you can't possibly know all of that tech yourself. You need experts that you can call upon. And I think you have to have the ability to have no sort of shame when it comes to asking questions. So I have been able to harness those angels and ask them the questions and ask them what part of this tech is the most valuable to us, what can we plug in and go, what do we build ourselves, how do we build a bespoke platform. And also, of course, I was then connected to the people with the experience to be able to build it. So I think our tech, a bespoke system, is phenomenal. I think that the fact that we've been able to harness some of the systems that are out there and keep the cost down has been fantastic, because I never, as I said, it wasn't build tech for tech's sake, it was meet the needs of the people and utilize it to be able to scale here. And obviously we'd like to do that internationally. My husband has a fund in Cambridge, Robert. And so, you know, I get a lot of advice from him as well, which is really helpful. Our chair is Barnaby Perks. He's scaled AESO. So he has lived and breathed it. And he's been a fantastic chair for me, because I was really against that, the idea of having, and forgive me, for having a man telling me what to do. Having worked in construction all those years, I thought, oh God, I can't take it. But he's been an absolutely brilliant chair. We have a really wonderful, honest relationship where we give out to each other. And there are times we get on absolutely brilliantly and we are great mates and we'd love to go and see a match together or something. And there's other times we can't bear to look at each other. And I think it's just this level of flowing honesty. So it's been fantastic. The whole community, I feel, as I've never felt shy in being able to go and ask somebody, how do I do this? I don't know how to do that. What does it look like? And sometimes with these exceptionally clever people in Cambridge, you know, people talk at a level in which is way above my understanding. And I have to keep saying, I don't get it. I'm still not getting it. So, and that's how it is here, I think.
I mean, it's a great story. It sounds like you've surrounded yourself with some really, a really good team. I guess, you know, to kind of wrap things up, it'll be really interesting to understand where the business is right now in terms of your kind of growth. And then, like, what does 2024 look for you, you know, moving forward?
From September of last year, we started our investment round, our next round, which is a sort of seed plus round. We've had in about, I think it's 228K of that round now. We were looking for 500. We took a bit of a gap just before Christmas because it's exhausting raising money. And it was those first calls in September were going incredibly well. And then when, and this is just, you know, the environment, I think, in the world of startup. So when it kicked off in the Middle East, a lot of people, you know, stopped putting the funding out there. And I think a lot of angels that we were talking to weren't in a position to spend more. They wanted to hold reserves. So it did change the profile of what I would have hoped to have been like by Christmas. So we took a bit of a break. And I think it's, you know, it's mentally battering going through an investment round, isn't it? When you get that, yes, I'm trusting you with my money. I mean, it is a dizzying, absolute amazing feeling of euphoria. And when you get off a call and you've had, you know, one after the other of three no's, it's a crashing through the floor, weeping, crying mess. And so, of course, I'd had that for that last quarter, took a bit of a break, took time off. And I think over Christmas, I spent a lot of time just staring into space, recovering. And then I came back at it in January. So we've raised some more money this in the last month or so. And I'm still doing a bit of fundraising. So I'm looking to get that round completely closed. Although we have a year's worth of funding. We had to make redundancies because I realised that we weren't potentially going to get the full round in the time we needed to. So we had got to the place where our tech was built. We'd road tested it. We'd had users through Deepak's private clinic through it. And we'd had amazing testimonials off the back of it. So unfortunately, the tech team left and we have, you know, a smaller tech staff, which has worked very well. Because otherwise, again, I think that you can keep building tech for the sake of it without really responding to the needs of your customers. You've got to go and get customers. So we've concentrated on getting ourselves a business development team, really understanding product market fit and actually going out there consistently and, you know, bringing in the customers and understanding the different verticals. So that's where we're at. Now, in terms of 2024... we're on the UK Innovate Edge programme, yes, and we have Stephen locally, who's been absolutely incredible supporter. He has helped us with an application for the potential of going to Texas as part of the sort of outreach programme so that you can see what it's like to work in a state in the US. So Robert and I went out the October before to Boston, which was just an absolute joy. We met some investors, like Morningside was one of the investors we met there, and we had an absolute blast. We took the kids with us as well. It was a holiday, but we just had this blast of what's the art of the possible for us to be in the US. We are on WTW, which is one of the world's biggest health brokers vendor profile tool, And we do get some inquiries at the moment from the US markets. We don't know of anyone in the US at the moment that does what we do. But of course, they have a pricing model which would suggest that they are better equipped to pay for it. So we will be looking at where would we go? How would we be supported? What would that look like to explore that market opportunity in the US? But in a quite a contained way, we've got to grow it and really understand the niggles and the things that make it fall over here first. So I'm acutely aware of that. You know, Robert and I are open to whether or not, you know, if this did really kick off in the US, would we go? Yes, there's been five generations of my family, the Cassans, who have gone to Boston. You know, it's like overrun by Irish, isn't it? It's mad. And I actually felt really at home. I loved it there. And it's quite a gritty city, isn't it? But it was just such fun. So, and I'm saying that with a great deal of naivety, because there's a difference between seeing a city and living there. Get it? So we will be dipping a toe in, trying to understand that market. We will be in pursuit of sales. You know, as there's no other way of putting it, we really have to drive sales this year. We've got a year's runway, as I said, with our reduced team. And this is the year that, by Christ, we have to sell it. And we have to understand who's paying for it and who's maximising in terms of getting the best out of our services. So that is our big, big focus of the year. We'll be pushing on a number of verticals. I mean, it has been said to me many times, I'm great at finding opportunities, but you've got to close them. You've got to close. And that's what we'll be focused on in the year ahead. We need to get to ourselves into a place where we've secured at least $500,000 of revenue. It will be a mix between the SaaS aspect and, you know, program sales, which is priced differently, because we need to get our Series A investment by the end of the year. So it's another big year. And it's kind of funny, isn't it? Because, again, I think that naivety that I had when I first started, I thought, you get your first couple of rounds, it kind of gets easier. I'm not sure that is ever true, because even, you know, last night at the event, hearing from the CEO of Pragmatic from a Series D round, and it's like, wow, you know, that's not going to get easier. And the rapid scale is never going to get easier. It's different problems. It's like growing children. So I recognise that it's going to be, you know, one hell of a year again. I think it's really important that as we go into this year, the company is not all about Sheila Cassan anymore. It's about the people around me who can rise up into their roles and be the face of this company and do a day-to-day really good job. So that's what I would like to see. Obviously, in a world of utopia, I would like to think that we get to a place where we are a name that's synonymous for driving quality of life and changing lives for people. And I haven't mentioned the preventative health, but 30 to 40% of chronic illnesses are preventable. And so we also have a preventative healthcare program for employers. So we can really drive this support into organizations so they can support their employees to make lifestyle changes that are meaningful and profound. And every time you do, it's good job, you're a hero. And I think we don't have enough of that. We don't celebrate enough. And I don't think we acknowledge how bloody brilliant we are day in, day out. So I think more of that would be a great thing. And if we play a small part in that, I'll be delighted.
What a way to end. You know, I think there's a whole load of descriptions here that you could come out with. You know, you've got passion, you've got that agility to be willing to change things. You know, laying people off is never going to be a nice thing, but you're a startup. You know, you have to make those decisions. You know, so I think that really comes across. And one of our earlier episodes with Fabo Shakouri from Phantom Technology, after it aired, he got lots of calls from investors. So fingers crossed.
Please do.
Fingers crossed. That might work for you as well.
I would love that. We have room in the round, and we would welcome some extra investment. And I think it's money well spent. And I think anyone who is listening, you will know people who have been through an illness, and you will recognise that at the end of their profound and brilliant treatment, it's been really tough for them. And so being able to offer that support, as I said, it's a joy to me, and it's also, I think, profoundly life-changing for the individual who receives it.
It's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Today's show was produced by Carl Homer of Cambridge TV and supported by our media partner, Business Weekly. The Cambridge Tech Podcast is available on all major podcast platforms and on cambridgetechpodcast.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please give it a 5-star review.
It will really help others discover the show.
The rules of business and society have changed, and Mish Kundureya stands at the forefront of this change, championing the innovation ecosystem at the heart of Cambridge. Our expertise is advising innovative companies at all stages of their life cycle. Discover what you can do at mishkon.com.
Cambridge Acorn Project is a local charity providing life-changing support to children and their families who've experienced trauma and abuse and are living in poverty. There's been a huge increase in demand for our services, and we're asking local people and organisations to support our work, giving more families the chance to emotionally recover from trauma and abuse. To find out more, please visit cambridgeacornproject.org.uk.